Welcome to Apologetics Profile, a podcast ministry of Watchman Fellowship, equipping the church, exhorting the non-believer, and exalting Christ. Here is your host, Watchman Staff Apologist Daniel Ray.
Cosmologist Alexander Vilenkin, who does not himself identify as a theist, believes that though the exact beginning of the universe is relatively unknowable, from a logical standpoint, however, it does appear to him that there must nevertheless have existed something prior to the beginning of the universe. But what exactly? Vilenkin opines, quote, "I cannot really claim that I understand the beginning of the universe. We have a picture which kind of makes sense, which I think is an achievement. Because if you think about it, you can say, okay, what happened before the Big Bang, before inflation? It seems you can keep asking these questions, and the answer is impossible. There's an interesting thing, though. The description of the creation of the universe from nothing is given in terms of the laws of physics. That makes you wonder, where are these laws? If the laws describe the creation of the universe, that suggests they existed prior to the universe. The question that nobody has any idea how to address is where these laws come from, and why these laws in particular. So there are a lot of mysteries to keep us working." End quote. Indeed, the cosmos does seem like it will continue to provide job security for a lot of physicists and cosmologists in the years to come. Vilenkin, though, goes on to contemplate the implications of laws existing prior to the universe. Quote, "It follows then that the laws should be there even prior to the universe itself. Does this mean that the laws are not mere descriptions of reality and can have an independent existence of their own? In the absence of space, time, and matter, what tablets could they be written upon? The laws are expressed in the form of mathematical equations. If the medium of mathematics is the mind, does this mean that mind should predate the universe? This takes us far into the unknown, all the way to the abyss of great mystery. It is hard to imagine how we can ever get past this point, but as before, that may just reflect the limits of our imagination." End quote. In light of the burgeoning weirdness and mind-bending discoveries in physics in the last century, the skeptics' objection that Christianity is weird has little weight. Of course, Christianity is strange to those on the outside, but like physicists who study the strange behaviors of space, time, and the particles they have so far detected, and tell the rest of us that the universe is bizarre beyond belief, so too do many Christians admit that Christianity is strange, enigmatic, sometimes terrifying, sometimes comforting, but often beyond our finite human comprehension. Finally, there's just no getting around the inexplicably wondrous and mind-blowing nature of the physical cosmos. Whether you believe God made it or not, the cosmos staggers human imagination. What has been eminently troubling and comforting all at once for me personally is that the one who made the universe and all it contains is called a man of sorrows. Isaiah's elegiac but hopeful prophecy of the suffering servant comes to its fulfillment in the shortest verse in all of Scripture. Jesus wept. In the 35th verse of the 11th chapter of John, Jesus is before the tomb of his friend Lazarus. Lazarus' sisters are sorrowful, Jesus is weeping, even the Jews gathered around him see how much Jesus loved Lazarus. But why would Jesus weep, knowing that he was about to bring Lazarus back from the dead? Jesus was both fully God and fully man. His very human tears fell upon his divine countenance. The one who made the heavens and earth, who separated the waters from the waters, and fashioned the stars by the breath of his mouth, cried tears of sorrow for his deceased friend. And then, Lazarus, come forth. wonder of wonders. Have you ever considered precisely how Lazarus was able to obey Jesus' command? He was dead, and yet he obeyed. As the late English evangelist Leonard Ravenhill said, quote, "Jesus did not come into the world to make bad men good. He came into the world to make dead men live." End quote. Apologetic defenses of the Christian faith can often seem like a rather dull intellectual slog that convinces very few people of the truth of Christianity. Many clever atheists know counterarguments to apologetic arguments and steadfastly remain committed atheists and agnostics. What then is missing? Is apologetics a waste of time if so few are convinced by the arguments? And what about the myriad of people who become Christians who have absolutely no idea about apologetics? Our guest this week and next, theoretical chemist and adult convert to the Christian faith, Neil Shenvey, offers some answers to these questions. He is the author of Why Believe? A Reasoned Approach to Christianity, published by Crossway in 2022. Neil's book provides basic apologetic arguments in defense of Christianity, but he also makes his arguments eminently personal. Why Believe is not your typical abstract apologetic rumination about the plausibility of the Christian worldview. Rather, Shenvey brings it all home, to the heart, reminding believer and skeptic alike just what is personally at stake for each one of us. From cosmology to the cross of Christ, Neil demonstrates that the physical world and the Gospels were not created for us to say, that's interesting, but to overwhelm our entire being and engender repentance, reverence, and worship.
If I knew that Vladimir Putin had whole files on me and was watching me every single day, I'd be like, that is going to change how I act. If I knew he's got, you know, if I knew that I was subject to that kind of scrutiny from someone that powerful, that would affect every single second of the day. Well, you have someone about a billion times more powerful and good who cares that much about you, who knows you that well. That should change how you live.
So there are not only laws which existed prior to the origin of the universe, but a lawgiver, the lawgiver, who is not only responsible for the existence of the universe, but who also loves us and who gave us his only begotten Son, that whoever so should believe in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. As we begin our conversation, Shenvey points out that we have, unfortunately, grown accustomed to the false belief that the ultimate meaning about the physical cosmos resides solely in what it and everything else within it, including us, is made of. Here is Neil Shenvey.
I think it's a good point to make that we have divorced fact from value and fact from meaning. So the idea is if we know what something is made of materially, that's we've exhausted all there is to it. We're just stuff. Everything is stuff. Everything is tangible. Everything can be measured. And if you can't measure it, it's not really there. It doesn't exist. And that's sort of an underlying assumption of a lot of modern people. Ironically, it's not an assumption shared by a lot of modern physicists. Now, I'm not saying all, but as a theoretical chemist, I found that my colleagues were much more open to the idea of intangible realities. And this is relevant to my own personal specialization in quantum mechanics. So, for example, in quantum mechanics, there are all kinds of realities that are in some very real sense real, and yet they are by definition not measurable. A great example is the wave function. There is extremely detailed literature on what is a wave function. What is it? It's sort of a fundamental element within quantum mechanics, and yet philosophers and scientists will ponder, what does it really mean to something to this wave function to exist? I can't get into the details. It's mathematical, but
oh, sure.
There are many interpretations, in fact, of what the wave function is. And it's beyond, it's not about what particles are made of. Wave functions are these ethereal abstract concepts that are incredibly important in quantum mechanics, but you can prove they're unmeasurable. You can't measure them. So it really, it immediately flies in the face of the idea that all that's there is tangible, measurable stuff that you can see, touch, smell, taste, hear. If you probe even deeper into physics, things like string theory are very controversial. But other elements of modern physics are also equally bizarre. I bring this out in my book, is that I think atheists oftentimes today are working from this very antiquated, anachronistic, Victorian conception of science. Everything is a ball bearings and billiard balls and springs. Right. And it's like a clockwork universe. It's really the image that we have in our heads, but that's just not modern. It's not 20th century. It's not even 20th century physics, let alone 21st century physics. So I think the bottom line is, if you're really willing to dive deeply into science, modern physics, then you're going to be confronted with very bizarre views that are inescapable. And I think that can serve as a bridge to say that you can't merely dismiss Christianity because it's weird.
Yeah.
The universe is weird, fundamentally.
Right.
And you can, there are different kinds of weirdness, sure, but you can't escape weirdness. Mm-hmm. You're never going to go back to the old-fashioned steampunk era of, of Tesla coils, right, and things, right, bubbling. And being, right. It's a very naive way to view the universe today. And I would just start there. I'd say, hey, if you really say, I can't believe in God or in angels or demons or even a moral reality, good and evil, these are not tangible. I can't put them in a test tube and measure it. I'd say, well, welcome to the party, pal. You can't measure lots of things in modern physics. There are lots of spooky things. I mean, Einstein referred to quantum mechanics as black magic calculus, and he referred to quantum entanglement as spooky action at a distance. So Einstein disliked quantum mechanics, but now it's true. It's as close to the truth as we can get right now. It's the most verified theory in the history of physics. So, like it or not, you're stuck with the really weird stuff. And so I use that as a wedge to say, you can't just write off a view because you don't like it. You can't just write off a worldview because it seems strange to you. As a scientist, I'd say, I remember actually, believe it or not, I read my first book on quantum mechanics when I think I was in eighth grade. I didn't understand much of it. I got it from the library. But I remember it was no later than ninth grade, but I remember reading about the entanglement and the Bell inequality, and basically it's very deep quantum mechanical stuff. I remember them describing this particular experiment that proved that classical mechanics, meaning Newtonian mechanics of particles and billiard balls, that kind of view of reality, was false, empirically, experimentally false. I read that section of this book and I sat down as like a ninth grader. It's like, I'm going to disprove this stuff. It's like, this can't be right. I'm sure I can come up with a theory as a ninth grader that shows that all of these brilliant physicists have been working for decades are just obviously wrong.
Wow.
But that's how it just shook my ninth naive, what was it, 14-year-old intuitions about reality. And I was not a Christian at the time. But the point is, like, that's it. If you are not, I think Feynman said, if you're not disturbed by quantum mechanics, you haven't understood it.
That's right.
Isn't that shocking?
And it is. Richard really,
Feynman's a brilliant physicist.
He is. He played bongo drums. He drew those Feynman diagrams for which he became so well known. And one of my favorite quotes is from Feynman about the fine structure constant, where he says, this ratio, it's something to do with the proportionality of electrons and their energy fields. You know it better than I do. But without this ratio of 1/37, we don't have carbon, and everything else seems to resonate this particular fine structure constant. Mm-hmm. And he's scratching his head in wonder, going, why this number? There's nothing in our calculations that give us this number or that would predict this number. It's like it's there for us to use like magic utensils at a dinner party that just show up on the table. We can't figure out why they're here, but they're useful. And in order for us to do physics, we have to use these enigmatic tools, but we don't know where they came from. And I love how I can hear the urgency and the, I wouldn't call it terror, but just this fascination, uneasy fascination with where do these numbers come from? And he concludes the quote by saying, you know, it's like God took his pencil and we don't know why he did this. You know, of course he wasn't a theist and using God colloquially, but it's that kind of mystery, Neil, that continues to drive, I think, and as you say, beyond the popular level atheism, and you're familiar with it with your own colleagues in theoretical chemistry, there are more, it seems like there's more and more scientists and theoreticians and cosmologists and people within the sciences going, you know, even in natural selection, 2016, the Royal Society convened and said, hey, neo-Darwinian evolutionary mechanisms are not sufficient to explain what's going on. It seems like the sciences are recognizing slowly, or maybe not slowly, that like Peter Benchley said in Jaws, you need a bigger boat. Conceptually, we need something else. And it seems to be like Stephen C. Meyer came out with this book a couple of years ago. Is the God hypothesis returning because of all this weirdness, do you think, Neil?
It's probably fair to say that some of the dogmatic atheism of the neo-atheist years, like the new atheist movement of Dawkins and Hitchens, seems to be somewhat tempered recently for various reasons, and some of which are not scientific or religious, they were cultural. But I do think that sort of hubristic attack on theism, like, oh, it's just childish, it's stupid, it's ignorant, how can you possibly, it's like believing in fairies or in, you know, in the sun god. It's like, well, no, actually the idea that mind exists, it's not just this epiphenomenon, we're not just particles in motion, there's a moral realm in the universe, there are intangible realities, that's not a crazy idea. In fact, that's a very, I argue in the book, that makes a lot more sense of our daily experience, and even makes sense of why we how we can even do science. Why do we live in a rational universe? Well, it makes sense if we live in a universe that was a creation of a mind. And of course, that doesn't get you to God, let alone Christianity. It could get you to deism, but I think it cracks the door open. And interestingly, I think that many atheists, and in some sense, all human beings, are desperate to slam that door shut because we don't like what's on the other side.
Right.
This is a great anecdote. I got to share it.
Absolutely.
I gave a talk at Duke years ago, probably like 10 years ago now. I gave a talk at Duke to one of their student ministries, and the title was something like, Does God Exist and Does It Matter? And before the talk, I was in the auditorium, and there's a guy sitting in front of me, and he kept glancing behind at me and looking at me. And it finally turns around, and he goes, is this going to be like a sermon or something? I want you to know I'm an atheist. And I said, you know, no, this is going to be like a lecture. I have slides. I'm going to talk about evidence for God's existence. He said, okay, that's fine, because I'm an atheist. And then, of course, the talk starts, but they began with the worship time. I'm like, oh no, you know, this ministry where sing some songs or something. But I got up there and I gave this presentation with slides and with quotes from prominent books and arguing that there's evidence that God exists. And after the talk, this same guy comes to me and says, kind of tentatively, he says, okay, I have a question for you though. Could I be a deist? And I was struck by that. And I said, because I presented the standard arguments like, well, there's evidence that the universe began to exist and points towards a creator. The universe is finely tuned for life. So there's a designer, there's a moral law, so there's a moral structure, there's moral reality out there. So I'd said all that. But he asked, can I be a deist? Meaning a person who believes in some kind of spiritual force out there, but one that's not involved with human affairs. Just kind of maybe a clockmaker God, maybe a ground for moral goodness and evil, but a God who kind of leaves you to do what you want. And that struck me because he felt the weight of the evidence, but wanted to avoid the possibility of there being a theistic God, meaning a God who cares how you live, a God who cares about how you behave, who wants you to know and love him, who's going to affect your life. And I kind of pointed that out to him. I said, of course, some of these arguments are compatible with theism, but think about the other evidence that I didn't really talk about, which is evidence, say, for the resurrection or evidence for Jesus being who he claimed to be. But that was a great, honest response. He seemed to feel the threat of a living God. We are okay with a dead God. We're okay with a distant God. But the idea of an all-consuming fire who wants you to love him and to worship him and demands and merits your obedience, that's a threat to us.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I even as a Christian of 30 years, Neil, you convey that well in the book, getting right down to, you know, arguments for God. But by the time you're getting to the end of the book, we're wrestling with sin and falling short of the glory of God. And one thing that has tempered me in my own walk and engaging with unbelievers is or people of other faiths is my own inherent sinful nature, which ought to be a cause for humility to some extent. And engaging with atheists through our book club, and I'm a part of a all in-person atheist club in Dallas here, so I'm in part of two clubs where I'm regularly talking to my skeptic friends. And I really enjoy it, and I really try to, what I've really enjoyed is really trying to steelman and understand where they are coming from. And I enjoy being open and honest about my own shortcomings and my own journey and my own doubts and things. Because I think one thing that we tend to do, maybe as Christians, is to whitewash our testimonies and our struggles and our doubts so that the way we look like to people on the outside is that we never struggle with anything. And we tend to make God, I speak for myself, we tend to make our faith a little bit legalistic, maybe. God, I'll do this for you. You do this for me. I'm not going to associate with sinners and tax collectors and dirty hands, people with dirty hands. And we kind of make, and at least I'm kind of describing my own journey, we somehow inadvertently make faith unattractive to people on the outside. And I think for me personally, that might be as the result of me not being entirely cognizant of just how odious my own sin is to God. And when I realize that, I'm going to be a lot less maybe judgmental or harsh about people that don't know God at all. And but one thing I think your book does is really bring that home in reminding us about our sin, both believer and unbeliever, even for the believer, that the exceedingly sinfulness of sin itself and just what that cost God in the person of Jesus.
Yeah, I think I was remember a quote, I think it's from Charles Spurgeon, who said that I'm just a beggar trying to show another beggar where to find bread.
Yeah.
A powerful quote. It's a great reminder that that's the posture we take. It's not that we're coming to you as righteous people who stand completely good on our own and we've made it and now it's time to call the pagans.
That's oh gosh.
It's right. Like everything I have. What is it? Paul says, what do you have that you haven't received?
That's right.
Everything you have is a gift of God's grace. So why do you act like it isn't? That's and that really has to shape and govern how we interact with non-Christians.
Yeah,
because you know they're but for the grace of God go I. And truly, and I think when people say that, it's almost you can say, "Oh, see, you think you've made it now." It's like, no, you don't understand that quote. That's what I am in my natural self, and grace is not about infusing. Justification is not about infusing me with goodness. Now I've made it. It's about God, you know, independent of everything that I actually am on my own, declaring me forgiven and righteous.
Right.
And so I'm coming to you and saying, hey, you can have that. You can be just as righteous as me, quote unquote, in the sense that we're both equally sinners. We're both equally forgiven. I tried to show that I bring that out in my book, is that is the message. And it is good news. It's not bad news. It's incredible news.
Well, and I've been recently meditating quite a bit, and I don't know why I haven't seen this in 30 years, but about a month or so ago, I'm reading John 11, and I'm reading the scene with Lazarus, of course. And, you know, you're moved by the shortest verse in the Bible where Jesus weeps. Jesus wept, and Mary and Martha are there, and everybody's crying, and the Jews like, well, look how he loved him. And, you know, the sisters are like, Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. He stinks by now. And Jesus is just heavy with sorrow and probably frustration, a little anger about sin in general and death, and maybe thinking of his own, what's coming for him. And then he calls forth Lazarus. He says, Lazarus, come forth. I don't know how many times I've read that. But at that particular moment, a question popped into my head. Daniel, how did Lazarus obey Jesus's command? He was dead. And I thought, that's the gospel. I mean, there it is. I am a dead man wrapped in the clothes of death. And Jesus bids me to come. And it's like the guy on the pallet in front of the fountain. Do you want to be made well? The guy can't even say yes. You know? The disciples are constantly not understanding what's happening. Peter denies Jesus. I mean, these are the people upon whom Jesus is going to build his church. And they don't exactly have the greatest LinkedIn resume for being ecclesiastical executives of this supernatural resurrection of the dead. Their Lord and their Savior is calling people who are mostly blue-collar and somewhat ignorant. But I think in that sense, Neil, that God is calling the dead to come forth. It's kind of a mini microcosmic resurrection of resuscitating dead people. We can't obey, but it seems like with Jesus's commands come the power to obey, and that seems to be the gospel, that there's nothing that Lazarus could have intrinsically took credit for in walking out of the tomb. You know, it just seems like maybe in modern evangelical, the way we've made something out of religion, that we've sort of said, you know, if Lazarus were to rise from the dead again today and he'd come forth and he'd go on the speaking circuit and write a book and say how he came out of the tomb and sort of methodologicalize his resurrection in a sense, you know, and make it all about him in some sense. But I think that's where the grace and the mercy and the wonder of Jesus is calling the dead to life, not just in the ultimate resurrection, but here and now, calling the dead to life by his grace through his word.
What's the quote? Is it Jesus didn't come to make nice people nicer? He came to make dead people live. There are a couple of variations on that, but it's true. Like, to the extent that we are quote unquote nice people and good people, that's entirely Jesus doing. And even us at our nicest and best is still filthy rags in God's sight. And so, but it's again, that's people. I don't really understand, although I guess I get understand theologically. When people hear that message that, you know, you are a sinner, you are utterly bankrupt morally and an utter failure, and you're under God's wrath, you can't do anything. They say, and Jesus offers you forgiveness. They'll say, oh, I can't believe it's a negative message. Oh, I don't want to hear how I'm so bad. I'm like, you know who, and I like, how could that not be good news to you? Do you know your own heart? But then I think to myself, you know who hears that message and receives it with joy? The people that did in Jesus' day, the people whose lives are failures. You go to jails, you go to death row, and people there hear that message. They say, I need that. That's nothing new. That was the way it was 2,000 years ago when you had the prostitutes, tax collectors. They're the ones saying, oh, you know, yeah, I can't. The whole like, oh, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and be better and do better. They're like, I've tried that. I can't. That's not good news for me. The good news is that Jesus can make this dead man live.
Yeah. I remember when I was young in my faith, I hadn't been a believer for very long. And I wanted to do everything that Jesus wanted me to do. So I eagerly accepted an invitation to go on a prison ministry visit. And I was a baby Christian. I'm an adult convert. I wasn't raised in the faith. I came to Christ when I was in my mid-20s. but I'll never forget, it was the Kentucky State Penitentiary. And we had the opportunity to go on death row, but we had to sit with the guard and be briefed on what to say, what not to say, that kind of thing. And I'll never forget the experience of talking to one guy who called me Brother Dan, and he had become a Christian while incarcerated, but he was on death row. I couldn't see him through the door, wasn't allowed to. And he said to me something, and I can still hear his words as I'm telling you this. I played church. Those three words. And that's what, he didn't go into detail, and we weren't supposed to ask why he was in there. But he said, you know, he kept saying, Brother Dan, don't play church. And, you know, I mean, I think to some degree, I'm sitting there, and I got that, I'm glad I got that message early on. Because what could be possibly worse, Neil, than masking the depravity of who we are? I mean, if you do that, what other kinds of things are you permitting? What in that suppression of the truth, in that unrighteousness, can lead to deadly consequences, not just for yourself, but for others? And that man's words just kept resonating in my mind, and to this day I think about it all the time. You know, don't play church. And so I've tried to live a life of being completely honest about my struggles with everybody, including my atheist friends. And some people say I'm a little too transparent sometimes, too hard on myself. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, no, I'm a little afraid of the old man that resides within me. Mm-hmm. And just seemingly slowly more coming to the recognition that God's grace is truly amazing, as John Newton penned with William Cooper about you know, amazing grace, about just what it means to be a wretch.
Yeah, this is why I wrote the final section of Why I Believe the Way I Did. So one of my motivations in writing my book was, well, to save money. So the story is that when I was a postdoc at Yale, we had a book table through CRU, Campus Crusade for Christ. They had a book table. They gave away free books. And that's part of my own story of how I became a Christian, was I got free books from CRU at a book table in college. And so I wanted to sort of pay it forward and repay that by doing my own book table and giving away free books at Yale. So they were handing out, you know, cheap copies of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, but I thought I can upgrade this. So I bought a box of Tim Keller's Reason for Gods and gave those out. But after giving away, I don't know how many dozens probably, but I was like, I can't afford this. I'm a postdoc. So I was like, I'll write my own book and give it away, so because that'll be cheaper. So that was the first inkling that I would write my own book. So nice. I'm going to just get it, you know.
That's good.
Same sort of arguments. Yeah. So when we were giving the books away, I was thinking about, okay, well, if I wrote a book, what would I have to offer? Because I really like Keller's book, and there are lots of great books out there. But one of the things that I did find that many apologetic books didn't do was to really address people at an existential level. It was very intellectual. Well, here's reasons to intellectually think that God exists, to intellectually even believe that Jesus was the Son of God and rose from the dead. The Christianity intellectually is true. But I wanted to talk more about you know, the need, or something deeper that really gripped them at more than just an intellectual level. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I came across, I developed what I call the argument for the gospel, which is this kind of surprising claim that the gospel itself, this message of Jesus dying on the cross for our sins and rising from the dead, which everybody agrees that's the core of Christianity. Well, that message is evidence for the objective truth of Christianity. And that I had not seen anywhere else. You know, my book, largely the material in it is familiar to people. Maybe there are new wrinkles on it. I engage with a lot of atheist scholars and mm-hmm. I try to do that. But I think this idea that the gospel is evidence is a new one. I've never heard that argument made before. Mm. And the idea is that, and that answers a lot of questions. So one big question that atheists could rightly pose to Christians is this: how are most Christians justified in their belief in Christianity? So I pose it this way at conferences. I say, if I were a clever atheist, I would not start by saying, well, Christianity is false, or there's no evidence at all for Christianity, because there's often some evidence for lots of false beliefs. I mean, you can come up with evidence for all kinds of, you know, false beliefs that, you know, some evidence goes towards the belief, but then most of the evidence goes against it. So I wouldn't say, well, if Christianity, there's no evidence for it at all. I could grant, oh, there's some things that are kind of interesting that I could see it being evidence for Christianity as being true. But as an atheist, what I would say, if I were clever, was I'll grant you there's some evidence out there. There's some. But you claim that Christianity is a reasonable, rational faith, that you can be a Christian for rational reasons based on these arguments you've given me, like the fine-tuning of the universe, the Kalam cosmological argument, or the moral argument. But here's the thing. The vast majority of Christians throughout history and even today have no knowledge whatsoever of these arguments, right? I mean, you ask some Christians, do you understand apologetics? They'll say, what's apologetics? Mm-hmm. They don't even know what that word means.
Right.
They don't know what the Kalam cosmological argument is. They don't know the evidence that Jesus rose from the dead. They don't know any of that stuff. So if I were an atheist, I'd say what you have to admit that is that the vast majority of Christians today, even if Christianity were true, but their belief that Christianity is true is unjustified, meaning it's not warranted. They don't have enough evidence to believe that it's true. So, for example, you know, I could say there it's true that the Earth is a sphere or is a globe. It's not flat. But the average person isn't. If you ask them, well, how do you know that the Earth is a sphere? They wouldn't. I don't know. I read it in a book somewhere. Well, how do you know the book's telling the truth? I'm sure it's telling the truth. Or how do you know the moon landing wasn't faked? Like, there are people out there that say the moon landing was faked. So how do you know it wasn't faked? Well, I read it in the book. Well, that book was fake too. So there are lots of beliefs that are true. I mean, obviously I believe the Earth's a sphere and the moon landing was real, but there are lots of beliefs like that where you could argue that our beliefs are unjustified. They're true, but not justified. So they don't constitute knowledge. Okay. So then how do you respond as a Christian? Cause it's true. You ask go out in the street corner, stop 100 people. And how many of those people are Christians or professing Christians, and ask them, why are you Christian? And they've done stories like this. And most of them will say something like, well, I just think it makes sense. But if you really press them hard enough, they're kind of gonna be like, well, I'm not sure. I just believe.
You've been listening to Apologetics Profile, a podcast ministry of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated. For more information about our ministry and resources, visit our website at watchman.org. You can help support Apologetics Profile by becoming a patron of the podcast at patreon.com/watchmanfellowship. That's patreon.com/watchmanfellowship. For Watchman Fellowship, I'm Anna Marie Smuts.